Absolute Rally with Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, Episode 5, Season 10. Have you got over the post-rally GB blues yet? I'm still struggling. And we finally, normally I'd say, you know, we've got Jack Bennion, we've got Ryan Champion, everything else. Slightly different this week. I like to mix it up a little bit. We've got Ryan Champion, but we've also got his agent with him, who has enabled us to book him in to finally get him back on the podcast. Trevor Agnew, who, of course, not only does the WRC Stage M reporting, obviously a very competent co-driver, now Ryan Champion's agent. And we cross over to them now in a private room somewhere in Milton Keynes. Ryan Champion and Trevor Agnew, hello.
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 Hello. Trevor, are we okay to talk to Ryan?
Yeah, we'll give you 10 minutes to start, but to see how you get on.
Happy days. Thanks for that, Trev. Thanks for that. Boys, it's a very odd way to start. We've got two people in the same place at the same time, which I think is possibly a first when we're recording it live. So there you go. Well done, Ryan. You've broken new ground.
Well, thank you. You know, we try and mix it up a bit, don't we?
Absolutely. And now everybody on who listens to the podcast wants to know, where's the new coat?
Well, the new coat isn't actually in Milton Keynes this week. The new coat's at home. I did wear it on Bonfire Night because it was very useful on Bonfire Night.
If that was your TV coat that you broke in, which was very impressive.
Yeah, it did make a debut on Channel 5, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Have you come down now from the elation of being in front of the camera? Because it affects some people. I don't know if you know.
I'm finding I can keep my feet on the ground, no problem.
Good man.
So, dealing with that. But, no, great weekend, great to be part of it. And as Trev did, I probably interviewed all the drivers 3-4 times over the weekend and then got to talk about it a bit on TV. So it was good to do it.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, Trev was there doing Stage End. Trev, when you were you were probably encountering the guys probably pre- when Rye was getting, and you were getting them at Stage End, of course, where the hot and the sweaty, and obviously just got to the end of the stage. Did Elvin seem as cool at Stage End as what he did at the beginning of the stages?
Yeah, well, the whole way through it, incredible. Even I didn't see him after the fog, but I saw the stage after the last one of the day, and totally relaxed the whole way. There was a lot of talk about the tyres and this and that, and of course he had still had to steer it. He had to negotiate a very slippery rally, and he did it without putting a wheel wrong, really.
Now, Trev, before we go to it, obviously we've spoke about driver mind management and stuff like that in the past. Just very, very briefly, we had Rich Milner on last week, and we've also had Elvin on as well. And I kind of put this to Elvin himself and also to Rich. He has come back a very different character this year. Can you see maybe somebody been working with him or what? You clearly must see a difference.
Yeah, but I don't think it was this year. I think it was before he got in the R5 car last year. I saw him at the Autosport show. I think you were there as well. And he had to change co-driver, remember, but he was okay with that. But yeah, he was determined at that point that he was going to get back in that in the World Rally car. And we saw a totally different Elvin. Remember Monte Carlo, Sweden, when he went out and he blew everybody away. He absolutely blitzed them. Same in the British Championship. He did it that year as well. And so, yeah, that was a big change.
Fantastic. Right, you were obviously there. We've joked about it, but you were there obviously in official capacity from the rally forum right the way through to the end of the rally. You were encountering the drivers all the time too. Was there any drivers that didn't seem at one with the event? Hayden springs to mind, for instance. Was it a big ask for instance for Hayden to come back in and be back on the pace?
I think it was quite the opposite. I think you could have asked, was there any drivers at one with the event? Because Elvin was pretty much the only one. I would say every other driver at some point complained that the car wasn't working. They couldn't make it work. It was understeering. They didn't have enough grip. Hyundai certainly on the first day were struggling. But having said that, Thierry Neuville and Andreas Mikkelsen seemed to start going very quickly then from day two on, whereas, you know, Hayden unfortunately was still a little bit at odds with the car throughout the event, and Toyota were really scratching ahead. Again, we saw an unfortunate mistake from Juho Hannanen to finish his World Championship year off. Lappi was just struggling all weekend, and his body language said exactly the same. Latvala improved the car slowly over the course of the weekend, but even he was still a little bit frustrated that he didn't have the ultimate pace. I think we knew going into the rally that Citroën were going to have a tough weekend with not having tested in Wales. And, you know, and that proved to be the pace, proved to be the case. But actually, Chris Meek was quick to begin with. He was on the pace. And I think that was Chris Meek. It was Chris Meek driving the doors off the car early on. But then the Hyundai started going a bit quicker. Latvala started going a bit quicker, and they got past him. You know, I think Chris was driving the wheels off the car, but the car wasn't quite under him to do any better this weekend or last weekend.
I think Jack mentioned it on last week's podcast, and you know, we were desperate for you last week, but you weren't there. That's all I'll say. But understeer did seem to be the common thing, especially in the Hyundai camp.
Yeah, and I don't think it was just Hyundai. I think it was also Toyota as well. I think we've talked about it during the year. The 2017 cars seem to have quite a small setup window. And, you know, when they work, they're fantastic. But when they get outside that, then they're a bit of a handful. And the conditions certainly seem slippier than what the majority of teams were expecting. And the cars certainly didn't generate the grip initially. Obviously, the opposite to that was, I mean, M Sport obviously had a good baseline setup even on the Michelins, but the DMAT just worked perfectly. And there was a concern. I spoke to Gwyndaf Evans the night before the rally, and Gwyndaf was concerned that the special tyre that DMAT had produced would be too soft, but obviously it proved to be quite the opposite, and it ended up being perfect for the conditions.
Yeah, I said, Joe, you just brought me to the next point, really. Is that, do you feel that the fact that the event was obviously earlier in the year, and, you know, we always assume that it's going to be a wet, cold, blustery Wales Rally GB. Obviously, being in October, that half-term period, were the teams perhaps caught on the hop a little bit?
But it still ended up being a wet, cold, blustery Rally GB. It was just, there was a little bit more sun than we maybe normally see, but the conditions, you know, seemed every bit as slippy. The stages, despite not having so much rain during the event, the stages never really dried out. And yeah, I don't know, really, because the conditions, I would say, were typical Rally GB. It was maybe slightly warmer than what we'd normally see, but it was certainly wet, it was certainly muddy, and it was certainly foggy. The setups definitely weren't quite there, but it, you know, it proved to be a challenge despite the fact it was run earlier in the year.
I think there's a bit as well. Yeah, where everybody focuses on the test, the pre-event test that people are doing or not doing, and Citroën said it out in France. But I remember Citroën, I think, brought the 2017 car over towards the end of last year. So they did a test, if I remember right, in Wales, so they would have got some data from that. But everybody focuses on this test, this magic test, and in reality, it's a 3 to 5 kilometre piece of road, which the more you go down, the more it cuts up. So it doesn't really replicate what you get. So you go 3-4 miles into the rally, and it's a completely different setup. And I think there's a bit of that with the 2017 cars, certainly with an active centre differential, which we've seen all year, everybody really struggling to dial the car into certain conditions. You can go to one rally, it'll work one day, it might not work the next. We saw it in Portugal. And then you go to events like Sardinia, where it's a little bit softer. You know, Portugal in particular, I remember Ozzy had a brand new car for it. I was out working on it, brand new car for the event. And before, you know, in one word, asked Julian what it was that they were struggling with up to that point. And I think he said traction. So they were able to get that sorted for that event. We'd go to the next one, they couldn't get the balance right. So I think this centre differential is, in particular, has caused a few problems. But Toyota was completely different this time. They'd set up for dry. At the end of Havering, we got all of the drivers, especially Hannanen and EP. So Lappi and Hannanen are saying that 37, 38 seconds off the pace. They could not understand where the time had gone. And the only way, Ran and I were talking about this last night, the only way that would happen is really a lack of traction, which you can't really compare with the other drivers or the other cars, the other manufacturers. And just we're talking about, GB, there's one piece or one event which it sort of got lost a little bit in all the drama of the fog when they went through Aberdeen in the dark. But remember then, Seb Ogier had to fix the car, so he went off broke the wheel and broke the wheel, the brake disc as well. So everybody forgets about what he did. And to see his reaction at the end of Dovenant, where he drove that stage with three discs on his vehicle, so three brakes, and he was absolutely amazed. He said it was a miracle that he was able to get through the stage. I think at that point when he went off in Aberdeen, he thought the worst. So for him to get out and repair that car, get all the brake lines blocked off and get in and do the stage and set the time that he set, that is a true mark of a world champion, somebody who, you know, he was absolutely, his body language was incredible at the end of that stage, and he actually survived it, and he put in the time that he put in, and for me, that won him the world championship in Wales.
That's going to be one of those stories, I guess, that'll be a quiz question probably 5 or 10 years down the line. Boys, before we move away from what we've just been talking about with regards to centre diffs and stuff like that, obviously Jack and I didn't feel like we could talk about this stuff last week because we didn't know enough about it. Now we've got Ryan Champion, now we've got Trevor Agnew, so I want to explore this one a little bit. Is the issues with regards to the centre diff, does that come down to the engineer? Does that come down to the driver when they've done a test and they said, right, I'm happy with that map? Or where's the decision, and where, I don't want to use the word blame, but where does it lie? Engineer, driver, where does it go?
Well, it's obviously a relationship between the driver and the engineer. And, you know, ultimately the driver is the one piloting the vehicle. You know, he's the one getting the feedback. He's the one with the first-hand feeling of the car, and he's passing that on to the engineer. The engineer will make adjustments accordingly to try and improve the vehicle on the driver feedback. But I think, you know, key to this is, as Trevor said, that they've got limited amounts of knowledge with these cars in the conditions they're entering into. And, you know, they go and test on, as we've just talked about, you know, 2-3 mile section of road. And the car might work perfectly on that. But once you get into the rally, the conditions are slightly different. The grip level's varying. Then the car isn't doing what the driver wants. So I think the longer we run the new regulations, the longer we run active centre diffs again, we'll see less and less of this because the teams will gather more information. But, you know, ultimately it should be a joint decision between the driver and the engineer before the event. And then obviously once you've started the event, there's only a limited amount of opportunities the team get to make any changes to the car to improve it. So, you know, with the likes of with Hyundai, we definitely saw an improvement in their pace between day one and day two. But with Toyota, it wasn't just about diffs, whether it was diffs at all. The car was just fundamentally too hard, and they needed to go a lot softer with the suspension. But yeah, ultimately, the drivers is the one controlling the car, and the information starts coming from them.
I think the easiest thing is just to think back to last year when we didn't have an active diff. So what's the difference then, Rai? Just in simple terms, so our listeners can understand it. So you give me your version, I'll ask you a couple of questions around it. So.
I mean, the difference being that it's variable. So you can actually alter how the diff behaves under braking, under throttle, under acceleration, and also, you know, with throttle inputs in between. So it's completely variable depending on throttle input and braking input. And you can, you know, you can have a big change in those parameters that fundamentally alters the handling of the car.
Is it fair to say there's a balance there between the traction that you get and the balance of the car? So in other words, if you've got a differential locked up and you've got that programmed in, essentially, where you're getting the maximum traction, therefore, if you drive on the front of the car the way Ogier did, a really light turn in the way he does, he might struggle to get the balance right in that car because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in theory, a locked differential will give you the maximum traction, but it makes the car very hard to drive. You know, particularly if you took it to extremes of a front-wheel drive car, it's quite easy to understand. If you lock the two wheels together on a front-wheel drive car, you will get the best traction you possibly can, but the car won't go around a corner. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of compromise on a centre differential, really. You know, what you find is you get a high amount of locking under heavy braking, under full power, for example, it'll probably go somewhere towards fully locked, and then it varies in between.
So road cars are very intelligent now. We've taken readings, 25 pulses a second, wheel speed sensors, steering sensors, and they're quite intelligent when it comes to delivering the grip in certain ways. The other thing we need to factor in with the active differential in a rally car is left foot braking.
Yeah, which has a massive effect. So you want to, as you just rightly said, it is a compromise. It's a compromise between handling and traction, and the braking as well. Whether you alter the diff for any braking input, or whether you just leave it, what I mean by that is whether you're overlapping on the brakes. So obviously, if you're braking heavily for a corner, then you'll set the diff up accordingly. But then mid corner, it depends on driving style, because some drivers will either be just overlapping slightly, or some drivers are much heavier on the left foot brake through the corner. So again, that depends on the driving style.
It's going to be interesting in Australia. Again, it's a completely different surface compared to anywhere else in the world. The running order, of course, is critical in the first day. So we're going to see more of the same, I think, aren't we?
Yeah, because again, unique conditions, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Australia's well known for its loose gravel, the ball bearing type surface that really cleans. So, yeah, particularly I think road cleaning is going to be a big issue in Australia, as it always is. And as you just said, to a degree, they've got very limited knowledge of again those conditions. So they've had some dry gravel earlier in the year, maybe less so in terms of handling issues than what we saw in GB. But I think road position will be key once again.
Yep.
Sorry, boys. I was just listening there. It was quite nice. I did have my hand up at one point to ask a question, but nobody's seeing it, so I just thought I'd leave you to it. So thanks for Trev. I feel like I should have handed over the podcast to you now, to be honest, which is fine. No, honestly, it's great because it's weird because I do sometimes listen back to it, obviously for audio quality, but at that moment I was just purely a listener there, so I hope everybody picked up on that. I want to go standout moments, because as ever with this podcast, everyone always knows what's going on with regards to results and stuff like that. So we don't tend to cover those things. And I always kind of reiterate those points. But right, your standout moments from GB. And the reason why I'm asking this is because you've done it a number of times. I've done it a number of times. Trev's done it as well. I've been okay over the last few years not doing it. I've not done it now for 2 years. But this year, and I don't know whether it's because of what happened with M Sport, and we're going to talk about that in a second, and what happened with Elvin, it was the first year in a long time that I really, really was devastated I hadn't done it.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we've been involved in the event, and we'll see what Trev thinks, but we've been involved in the event. I didn't think that much about not doing it, honestly, because you've got your own involvement, you've got your own part of it that you're thinking about. And quite honestly, like I said, when you're interviewing the drivers, you're thinking about your next question, you're listening to their answer, then you're thinking about what comes next. And for me, during the whole event, I was sort of focused on actually what I was doing and really enjoying that been part of the media circus, I suppose. So, I can't say I actually, don't get me wrong, would love to have done it, but I didn't actually miss driving because I was busy during the event. I don't know how you thought, Trev.
Yeah, well, those days are gone for me. It's well over 12 years. My last sat in a rally car in any sort of anger. I've done a couple of tests and shakedowns and things, but I feel very privileged that I'm allowed to do what I do 3 or 4 times a year. It's as close to competing as you're going to get. There's no other part of the job, I think, in motorsport that gets that level of excitement when you're stood at the stop line as people come off a stage with all the different stories and dramas, the Osier one in particular. You know, imagine just the excitement when we saw it on camera when they finished that foggy stage in Aberhiernan. For me, the standout moment was on the Sunday, of course. I did the middle stage, so I was free for the last one. I went to the end of Brennig, to the end of the power stage, and just to savour the atmosphere there, the Welsh fans were incredible. Gwyndaf Evans, Elvin's dad, arrived with Howard Davis, and the crowd went mad. And then I hadn't seen Gwyndaf for probably a couple of years, so I just stood talking to Gwyndaf and Howard. Howard could hardly talk, and that's totally unusual for Howard Davis. Our listeners will probably know about Howie and a legend that he is in Welsh rallying, but he was in bits, actually. He kept saying how momentous it would be, but didn't want to predict too much too soon. Gwyndaf was just stoic. He wasn't nervous in any way. he said, yeah, I'm here. And we had a chat about the times we had F2 rallying, which is a favorite of yours. And we chatted about the times we had. And got, actually, a friend of mine got on the phone to Glendalough because he hadn't spoken to him in a while, Gary Savage from the set days. So it was just lovely for that that whole side of things. And then as, of course, the Fiesta started to arrive, we were able to take off the boxes. So the first one in, obviously, was Oitanic, and that meant the manufacturers were one. Then there's a monitor at the end of the stage, Molly Pettit, who does the interview. She watches that. So I stood beside her, and all the DBAC guys were watching. When Elvin came in, and they're looking for me to give him the thumbs up. So once I saw him over that jump just before the finish board, I gave him the thumbs up, and that's when it all went mad. And yeah, it was an absolute privilege again, and a pleasure to be there and experience that. It's incredible.
It was, it, you know, we had, I watched the Channel 5 coverage, not because of Ryan, but I watched the Channel 5 coverage, and I was listening to it on the radio and stuff like that. And it just, I think probably, possibly because it was so close, but I just couldn't get there. Obviously, we'd have the little one for kind of, he was 10 days old at that point. And it was just one of those things that was just, it felt so close, but I felt so far away from it. And then maybe that's what it was, because you guys were kind of in the eye of the storm, as it were. But yeah, it was, it felt really special. And I don't know whether I'm just seeing it through rosy-coloured spectacles, because, of course, Elvin did win his first WRC round. He did win it in Wales. But we had Sebastien Ogier obviously winning his fifth world title. Obviously, M Sport securing the manufacturers. Do we feel a little bit let down, boys, by mainstream media, and that this hasn't been celebrated a little bit more? I feel a little bit frustrated by it.
Yeah, well, of course we do. I mean, we know rallying's dropped off the mainstream radar, and certainly in this country anyway. And it is unfortunate that if a British win doesn't get it back on the back pages of the newspapers, get it back on the TV news, then how's that ever going to happen? I mean, actually, Trevor and I were listening to Elvin's interview on Radio 2 with Chris Evans, and it's great that things like that are happening after the event. But at the same time, you know, these sort of wins should be the catalyst to see rallying back in the mainstream. But I think, unfortunately, we're still quite a long way off that.
I think, you know, and I don't know what you guys think, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday, I had some people over from America, and we were talking about rallying, and we were talking about different sports and things like that. And again, I don't want to get too bogged down with this, but, you know, the Premier League football over in the States is brand, you know, people don't have teams, they go out and watch Premier League. And I just think over the last, you know, 20 years, the Premier League is kind of taken over, and you know, people watch Premier League now. It's a thing and everything else. And of course, the newspapers are going to be driven by what people are watching. And obviously, you could get really, really cynical and think about just what Rupert Murdoch owns and things like that. But I just think that football, because of the money that's being generated in it, is just, I think it's dwarfed so many different sports. And, you know, maybe not quite to the same extent with F1, but, you know, even, you know, Lewis winning his title, yeah, that was relatively, you know, biggish news, but there was still a bigger football story on the back page of most of the daily newspapers.
Yeah, over here there would be, because it's such a big, as you said, the event and the show that goes with it. Most people are interested in this country. You grow up and you play football, and you certainly didn't grow up and go and watch a rally in Ireland. Of course, it's different. A lot of people did, and a lot of more knowledge of rallying in Ireland. I'm more concerned, Tony, you know, what we've had this year is fantastic. The 2017 cars, even though I didn't really see the need for them personally, I thought the cars were spectacular enough in 2016, if you looked at Finland and look at some of the events. But that was the route they chose to go, which is fair play. Because everybody had a new car, it was so different to what they had before. It's created a great spectacle. It's created a great competition. But my concern would be moving forward. I'd like to see a little bit more reference to what we're going to be doing in 10 years' time, or maybe even 5 years' time. I know certainly in Formula One, where Liberty have got Ross Brawn in to look specifically at a five-year strategy to try and work out now what they should be doing in 5 years and getting the teams on board with that. My work with car manufacturers, I certainly in Rank could second this, I'm sure. There's a lot of talk of electrification. You start to look at motorsport and how that's changing. You know, Porsche leaving Le Mans, Audi leaving Le Mans. You've also got Mercedes leaving DTM, all of those going to Formula E. This whole electrification route and where we're heading, 2040, I remember, in the UK in particular, every brand new car will have an electric motor in there, no combustion engines. So on the way to that, the manufacturers and the marketing departments of those and the board members who are not so interested in motorsport will all be pushing manufacturers down that route. So what is the equivalent? How can we introduce electrification or alternative drive into rallying? As you know, it fits quite easily into rallycross, and they are looking at it. But I haven't heard anybody mention what we need to do from a manufacturer point of view to get them interested in showcasing their alternative drive vehicles in rallying.
Right, you've spoke about this before. Again, Trev's coming in from a different angle, obviously, with what he does. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think there's two interesting points that Trev raises there, because, you know, with F1, you're seeing somebody like Ross Brawn at the helm, and you can actually believe that they've got somebody there who can react to what's going on in the world, what's going on in changing markets, and it'll do something accordingly. I'm yet to see that with the WRC promoter, honestly. Where is the WRC going to be in 5 years? I think these are the things we sort of need somebody to start telling us and talking, maybe not us, but certainly to be talking to the manufacturers about. And all right, we're not involved at that level, but you would hope that those conversations are going on, and that they're going on very, very quickly, because WRC is going to have to evolve whether we like it or not. And somebody needs to be having those conversations as to where the sport's going to be going in 5 years' time and in 10 years' time. And yeah, okay, we've seen the exciting regulations this year that have generated interest. But in order to keep the manufacturers spending the money going forwards and keep the manufacturer interest, we're going to have to see another big change in regulations. And I just hope that somewhere behind closed doors, things are changing a little bit more quickly than what they have done maybe over the last 4 or 5 years.
Do we think that 2017 cars, as we know them, when they'll always be known as that specification, do we think they will be the be-all and end-all in 2 or 3 years' time? The reason why I ask this, right, it's a slightly loaded question, and the reason why I ask this is obviously the news today of that's came out with regards to VW bringing their R5 out. Now, it's somebody whose name escapes me at the moment, who I was speaking to on GB, basically felt that maybe the future of WRC could be R5.
Yeah, but we talked about this, didn't we? Like 2 or 3 years ago, you know, when there was talk of changing the regulations, there was a crossroads, really. Already, the World Rally cars were very, very costly. I mean, even a 2016 World Rally car would have probably cost you somewhere in the region of whatever, €500,000. And these cars are significantly more now. And when the teams got to that crossroads, when the manufacturer and particularly the FIA got to that crossroads, rather than reducing costs, they chose to increase them. Now, that's been great short term. We've got a spectacular sport. We had more spectators on Rally GB this year than we've had for a long, long time. And there's real interest and excitement around the sport. But what worries me is, you know, how long can we sustain the increase in costs? I think, you know, if the choice to go to R5 was coming, it could have been taken then. But the problem is now we've gone so far away from that. We've got incredibly exciting cars. Whereas, quite honestly, you know, R5 as the premier formula now would be a bit like going from Group B cars to Group A cars in 1987. You know, it took sort of 3 or 4 years really before, certainly 2 or 3 years before the Group A cars were really exciting, and they didn't have things like restrictors back in those days. So I think we'd have to be careful if we were trying to go from, you know, 2017 spec cars to R5. I think, you know, as we've just alluded to, maybe there's some alternative power source that could give the same sort of performance and same sort of excitement, but be future proof, if you like. I think that would be the way I'd be maybe looking.
Interesting. Now, sorry, Trev, go on.
It just goes back to my concern. As I say, we've got IMG, who are an international promoter, an events coordinator. They're one of the best in the world. They're involved in rallycross. Rallycross is very much geared towards using electric cars, or certainly some sort of a CARE system on conventional cars. If the manufacturers see that as an alternative to Formula E and they start piling back in, then that would be a concern of mine, really, compared to rallying.
This is Absolute Rally, Pace Notes Rally Magazine, Britain and Ireland's only dedicated rally publication. Rally news, interviews, features and reports from Clubman Rallies to the WRC. Available from all good newsagents or subscribe at rallymag.com. Pace Notes Rally Magazine, your number one monthly rally read. This is the Absolute Rally Podcast.
Just a couple of things, just going back to what we've just been talking about, M-Sport and everything else. We had a nice message in earlier today from Ben Prickshard. And the reason why I'm reading out, apart from the fact that it's a really nice message, Ben, thanks for that. Little idea, maybe we need to push M-Sport maybe to get Team of the Year or Autosport or something like that, which I'm sure many people are already working towards. But he was just pointing out he normally listens to our podcast, sat on a beach in St. Lucia. There you go. Just thought I'd share that with you. Thanks, Ben. The boys are in Milton Keynes. I'm in Knowsley. That's how exciting it is. The R5 Polo that is coming. There's been artist impressions put out of it today. I'd heard some various things with regards to the Polo, boys. I don't know whether you'd heard much on the grapevine, but I'd heard pretty much nothing had happened with it for about 6 months. And up until recently, they were still, you know, testing the World Rally car. So to see this artist impression come out today, or certainly over the last 24 hours, I was a little bit surprised about it.
I thought it was coming. At the end of the day, you know, there is still a big motorsport department in Volkswagen. You know, it was a huge professional outfit that ran the WRC team. Obviously, part of that has been redirected towards the Rallycross program, which has been incredibly successful. You know, the Polo's really dominated in World Rallycross this year and actually made the competition scratch the head a little bit. So they've done a great job there. But I think the view was always that some of the spare capacity would go towards a customer program. And I think the development's always been going on in the background. But, you know, I don't think we're going to see a really high profile R5 Polo campaign. I think, you know, it'll be very much designed and built as a customer car.
Still very interested to see how all this pans out with Skoda, Trev. Obviously, the working brands, you guys obviously know the inner workings probably better than me. But do you see a conflict of interest here?
Yeah, potentially if it was, as Ryan says, if it was a factory effort, which we know it's not going to be, but a customer team, yeah, they can run. It depends, again, how professional a customer team is going to be and how much assistance they'll have from Hanover. But, yeah, you'd definitely want to have a go on one, wouldn't you? You know. And, of course, Skoda have got the car to beat in WRC2 at the minute. The Ford was quick last year, but they didn't get there in the end. Citroën, of course, the DS3, the R5 car that they're continuing to test at the minute. That's got to be a bit of a worry for them.
Interesting times. Boys, believe it or not, we're well over half an hour now into this. Now, I want to just tidy up a couple of things as well. Still no news on Seb. There's been quite a few things on Twitter, and I've seen read various things with regards to, is he going to retire? Is he going to stay? Because really now, the impression given that Sebastian Ogier is either going to stay at M-Sport for another year or retire.
Yeah, I think it's moving more and more towards that. Obviously, pre-Rally GB, we were hearing rumours of Citroën being interested again. And you could see the logic behind that. But you've got to question what sort of budget Citroën have. You know, they didn't come to GB to test before Wills Rally GB, which, you know, you can only assume was down to saving money. I think it's fair to say the drivers have said that there hasn't been the money there to develop the car in the direction that they would have liked this year. We're yet to hear if there's any Abu Dhabi money in the team next year, and we're hearing rumours of budget cuts. So I can't really see, and then Trev was saying the same last night, I can't really see that there's an opportunity for Ogier to go back to Citroën. And ultimately, look how emotional he was when he took the world championship win with M Sport. I think he said it was the sweetest moment of his career. And I do think his motivation is still there to stay in the WRC. I don't think we'll see him in the sport long enough to take 9 titles or to go beyond what Sebastian Loeb achieved. But I think his desire is still there to drive in WRC, which I think means staying with M Sport for another year. I don't know, Trevor, what you think?
That's good fun speculating.
But that's, well, we can do that.
That's really all it is. We can have a bit of a debate about it. But at the end of the day, he knows what Andrea's wife sent him. She was there at the end of the rally. He's got a young child, so maybe the decision is to watch his child grow up and spend a bit more time at home then. What does he go? Does he go for 10 World Championship titles then? I don't think that's going to happen. He's won it in a different car. He's won it against the odds. He certainly wasn't a favourite at the start of the year in most people's book, although his consistency will always shine through.
Do you think, Trev, sorry to interrupt, do you think, and you know, obviously, Sebastian Loeb, of course, was on the event doing coverage for Red Bull TV, and you know, he's been around. We know he sat in that Citroen as well. Bizarrely enough, I don't feel perhaps the motivation will come from Sebastian Ogier because Sebastian Loeb's coming back. But do you think perhaps he'll look at Sebastian Loeb and go, well, he's been drawn back. Maybe I need to do another few years. So once I do walk, I'm going to stay walked.
No, I don't think that. I don't even think that Sebastian Loeb and a car would motivate him that much. You have to question Sebastian Loeb's motivation if he got back in. And he'd do it for fun, obviously. He'd do it for joy. He'd want to be competitive. But any more than 2 or 3 rallies, I don't think that he'd be motivated enough to do it. He's moved on. He's trying different challenges. For him to go back into the car and do any more than 2 or 3 token rallies isn't going to happen. And that certainly wouldn't influence Ogier's decision, I don't think.
Now, obviously, the fact of the matter is they've lost Oit Tanak. I think we're all pretty much certain that Elvin is going to remain, but he will be in a Michelin car as opposed to a DMAC car next year, kind of being promoted up, I suppose, into Oit's place. He's desperately going to want Sebastian to stay with him, isn't he?
Yeah, why not? You know, the learning that was picked up from both him and Julian, you know, it's quite incredible how they've raised the whole spirit, effort and motivation of that team, and that's what they're good at, to be part of that and have that man in there demanding the way he's demanded this year. Is certainly going to help Elvin, no doubt about it whatsoever. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're Sebastian Ogier, where would you go? So the Toyota, we know, isn't fully sorted yet. The Hyundai, right the way through to the 2016 car, still looks fragile in places. The Citroen's not fully sorted on gravel. So it's going to be a pay rise or a reassurance of some sort that we're not party to that will make him move away from M Sport, because as it stands at the minute, the car's ultra reliable. It's consistently fast. You look at Oit this year, he outgunned Sebastian a lot of the time. He outgunned the world champion, no doubt about that whatsoever in some rallies. And fair play to Ogier, you give him credit for that. Ogier just wasn't able to dial the car in the way that Tanak did at times, and that's a big difference. So if I was Ogier, I'd stay where I am. But again, it's down to things that we don't know about, the commercial side of things. I don't see him going to Citroën unless somebody at board level or high up in the chain says, right, here's some money for him.
Right. I know it's still early doors and we've still got, obviously, the final round of the 2017 season to come. And you know, I'm sure big announcements could be being made. But you would hope and you would kind of pray, I suppose, that, you know, M Sport now, if it's not Ford, and, you know, there's been various things bounced around. I've seen a couple of things. Obviously, I think Gerard Quinn put a couple of people straight on Twitter, I've seen as well, with regards to Ford's involvement and things like that. But you would think now they've got to get somebody on board to support this program. They can't do any more.
Yeah, and I think it's a worry if they don't, because it goes back to what we were saying about
the promoter, you know, and promotion, yeah, and things like that. Yeah,
exactly that. And how big is the reach of the World Rally Championship if the World Championship winning team can't get a title sponsor then it's not giving value somewhere. So, yeah, and, you know, it's not the first time we've seen situations like this, but you would hope that M Sport, as world title winners with the best driver in the world, could attract a sponsor to do it. But, you know, if Ford don't come back, then they're not coming back for a reason, you know, because it's not giving them the value from it. We certainly don't see a big number of sponsors lining up for the sport at the minute. You know, the manufacturers that are there bring their relevant suppliers along, but there isn't many standalone sponsors.
If you're trying to get a 5 or 10 million quid budget or influx from a team title sponsor, whatever it is, I don't know what money it is, but certainly it doesn't sound a big amount of money compared to other types of motorsport. If you're going to back the world champion and the world championship winning team in a world championship event like rallying, Ryan's right, there's something not quite right. We're not adding enough value to it.
Now, how do we add value?
That's a difficult one, but you know, I think marketing, live streaming, potentially. I don't think we see enough of the WRC events live at the minute. The WRC promoter doesn't seem to be keen on you know, on promoting live streaming at the minute. They still want to sell the rights, but you know, we've got to reach more people. And to reach more people, I think we have to do that live, because that's how people watch sport nowadays.
I think there's definitely a need to get more, more celebrity type people involved and endorsing it and being amazed by it, being wowed by it. As Ryan was saying, Chris Evans the other day, Radio 2, 9 million listeners in the UK. Had an interest in it. He watched it and he did talk about the difference in that. He actually asked Elvin, who beat Lewis Hamilton in a straight race, won in a rally car, doing a rally and then doing a Formula One race in the cumulative time. Elvin, of course, said he'd win. But yeah, I'm going to just go back to Formula E. The race that they had in New York was, I think, the only Formula E race that I watched. And on the back of that, the celebs in there, that like Michael Douglas, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who were there. Three or four real high-profile people in the States were at that event. The racing wasn't fantastic. It was good, but you know, they're not the most explosive cars. But if you think of Formula One as an event and a place to be, where people want to be seen to be, we're a long way from that. The racing comes separate. You know, and that's why I think the whole profile and the people where we need to get interested and get them in the cars, get them experiencing it. You know, on events, we do that sometimes. Shakedown, we get celebs in. I didn't notice much of that in Rally GB this year. Normally, we've got a rugby player or we've got somebody in there. But I think that side of things, it is a super exciting sport for those of us involved in it. But enough mainstream people don't really appreciate what goes on, and to get people into the forests and Wales and get them standing there is a hard task. I've been in that side of it. I have been involved in looking after VIPs on rallies, and we need to find a different way around.
Yeah, and just on that, I mean, it was interesting with the Channel 5 involvement on the Sunday, because most of the, unlike the world feed that Julian Porter's involved with, and that you know, we see John Desborough commentate on, the Channel 5 team that came in to produce the show on the Sunday afternoon that I was involved with weren't rally people, and they were blown away by the footage. They were blown away by the excitement. Yes, there was a great storyline to it, but they genuinely loved it and were engaged by the sport. And we still can provide arguably the best images of any motorsport, but we still don't capitalize on that. But if those people came in who weren't interested in rallying and were blown away by the action and the footage, then it is possible. We just need to get it out to more people.
Well, someone like Chris Evans, if you had a helicopter room into that Brannock stage, watched it, or even the stage before, got him touched down, he watched the end of it and the emotion, everything went with it, then it'd be a different program on Monday morning at 6:30 when he went on air to his 9 million listeners. Then he'll talk about what he did at the weekend. Then he gets involved and then he starts to explain just how good it is. And that's a totally different thing to what we heard, which was on a Wednesday morning. It lasted about 2 or 3 minutes and he didn't really see the whole passion of it.
But Boys, just one thing that I can pick up from just listening to the two of you, which is quite, again, it's quite nice to just listen, but Ryan just said something there which I think is quite key, and you know, we all kind of wince, but you've just mentioned storyline, right? Now, we all, as rally fans, I suppose, we all know when there's been a little bit of a niggle, perhaps, between two of the drivers. I seem to remember the running order one with Seb and obviously Hayden having, you know, words and things like that, and there's been a few back and forth, but in F1, they turn it into a soap opera. Now, I feel that's too far, but it does create this thing of fan favourites and, you know, kind of the hero and villains. And that's something we really don't have. I suppose, funny enough, I think I mentioned this to Rich Milner last week. You know, most people had a bit of an opinion of Seb this year. I think that opinion has changed. But what we haven't got, we don't seem to be able to tap into the driver's personalities for people to kind of latch onto. And I think that's something else that we massively miss out on.
Yeah, I don't think we don't build the characters behind the storyline. You know, we see if we're on the event, we see the fans of the particular drivers, but we're not seeing people at home. We're not seeing armchair fans that engage with the sport that have their heroes. So you're right, we need to build up the characters. We need to build up the heroes and villains, and you don't want to falsify it, like you say, like we see sometimes in other sports, but you want people to get behind their drivers. And obviously that's why we know that Colin McRae, he really got people behind him. He really got people excited about the sport in a funny way, like Kimi Raikkonen does, you know, the sort of anti-character. But we need to see more of the characters. We need to see more of the passion behind the sport. I actually think we just need to shake up how the sport is covered. I think it's become a little bit generic. It's become a bit monotonous. I think we see very similar coverage from each rally, despite the fact that it has such different surfaces and just different backdrops. And we started to see for a while the magazine type programs that really went behind the scenes and brought out the lifestyles of the drivers and team personnel. And I think we need more of that. We need to bring more of the interest, more of the stories out.
Absolutely. Boys, we're at that point where we need to start wrapping up this section of the programme. We've got Dick Cormack coming up a little bit later, of course, the man behind the Max Sizer. We've got Paul Lawrence coming up with regards to the RAC rally, which is starting this weekend. So, boys, in true Absolute Rally fashion, I'm assuming that having done one evening of talking rallying and you're about to go into another one between you, also with Cliffy as well, you've got some great any other businesses.
Well,
no, clearly not.
Well, you stole mine. First of all, I was gonna go into the R5 Polo, but you stole that slightly.
Sorry, mate.
But obviously, one area of the sport that we do see going from strength to strength is R5. As Trev's already said, Citroën got the new C3 well on its way. Toyota rumoured to be developing an R5 Yaris. We've also just seen the competition debut of the new Proton R5 last weekend. And I think before the event, Marcus Gronholm was testing it. So Gronholm seems to have tested every new car that's been produced over the last 3 or 4 years. He seems to be the go-to test driver. So interesting to see him in the car. And, it is an area of the sport that's definitely doing very, very well. It seems to have found its niche at national level. But still, still an expensive formula, as we've talked about previously. With where does R4 fit in and all the rest of it? They're not cheap cars, but certainly the sales of these cars continue, and manufacturers want to continue building them.
Completely and utterly unmotivated by R4. That's all I've got to say.
Where is it going to go? It's just not. I think we've covered that one already. If anybody out there can tell us how R4 is going to work and how they're going to sell any cars out of it, we'd be pleased to hear the answer.
I can remember getting a bit of a hard time by somebody who will remain nameless, where I questioned, because obviously they tried to bring out the R4 kit for Group N cars to try and get them up to speed with Super 2 cars and IRC. I can remember it happening then. And I was still scratching my head then. And here I am 7 years on, scratching my head now. I still don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody ever has.
How does this happen? You know, there's enough clever people in this sport to create a structure, and we still don't really have any cost-effective rally cars. Yeah. That the for want of a better description, the clubman or the amateur level sport needs a cost effective car, and it still isn't out there.
Now, Trev, have you got a classic any other business in true Trevor Agnew style?
Yeah, who is going to win the World Championship next year?
I feel like that's a cop-out from you, Trev. I expected more.
No, it's not. Seriously,
next year's driver
is going to be in a car that he'll make competitive. He'll be consistent every rally. So he'll score points the way he has done over the last year and a half or 2 years. So who is going to be on the pace in a car? So no Tannock's in a Toyota. We're not so sure about the car. Will they turn it around? Will they do enough at the start of the year to make them competitive? We know it'll be competitive in Sweden. Who are the other? Elvin Evans in a Ford, and he's got to be a contender, no doubt about it whatsoever. If they can sort the Citroen on gravel, Chris is going to be up there. Even if it's not sorted, he's still be consistent enough in events. So you think about the team leaders in each of the teams.
Hyundai potentially Hyundai. With two competitive drivers next year.
Well, like, of course, Andreas Mikkelsen is very relaxed in GB. He's probably one of the most relaxed drivers that I interviewed at the end of the stages. So, yeah, it's going to be a big fight. And then the car needs to be, again, needs to be a little bit stronger than it has been. They started to look at that, I think. Interesting.
And Trev, you can't throw it out there with giving us your thoughts on who it's going to be.
I'll answer it.
Elvin Evans.
Wow. There you go. Boom. Deal with that. Evans, world champion 2018.
Quick on gravel, just sort out the snow and there we go.
There you go. There you go. Folks, please let us know your thoughts. You know where to find us now, of course. Absolute_rally on Twitter and absoluterally.co.uk. You can leave messages via there on facebook.com/absoluterally. Boys, it's been a great start to this week's episode. It's slightly different. Trev, thanks for joining us at the top of the programme.
You're very welcome, anytime you want.
Oh, there you go. Right, you'll be back same time, same place with us and with JB next week.
Yes, yeah, I will. Just before I head off to sunnier climates.
I know, of course. That's where we'll be doing your preview, of course, next week. We'll be doing your preview of what sun cream you're going to be taking and what...
I'm not bothered about the sun cream. It's the bug spray that I'm more interested in.
Okay. Yeah, fair dues. Of course, Rye will be flying off to do the Safari Rally, so we will talk about that next week. But folks, sit back, relax. We're going to have Dick Cormack coming up from DMAC and then Paul Lawrence from the RAC rally as well. So... folks, sit back, relax, and we'll be back after this break.
This is the Absolute Rally Podcast. Click motorsportauctions.com. Now, one of the world's leading motorsport online classified adverts and auction sites. It's easy to use, providing listing platforms that enable you to sell race and rally cars, surplus parts, transporters, clothing, workshop, and pit equipment. We specialise in cataloguing, listing, and selling large quantities of motorsport-related surplus and obsolete stock. Click motorsportauctions.com. This is Absolute Rally.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. And as I mentioned in the first section with Trev and with Ryan, we finally got to speak to the man who's probably had the longest hangover after Rally GB, second to only Elvin Evans, I'm probably guessing. Dick Cormack of DMAC Tyres. Welcome to Absolute Rally for the first time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It is good to have you because there's been so much said and it does feel like a lifetime ago probably for you now. But the come down of Rally GB, you couldn't have wrote a script any better, really, could you?
No, it was a perfect result. You know, we'd obviously we'd targeted that event to because we knew our tyre was really good there from last year. We'd targeted at that event to give Elfin his best chance of a British win, and you know, it worked absolutely to plan, so it couldn't have been any better.
Elfin obviously has came into that off the back of being British champion last year, because you've just had two British championship wins back to back, of course, the new British Rally Championship. Has that worked out a little bit more important than perhaps you first realised it would for moving the brand forward?
Yeah, definitely. I think the British Championship has been really good for us for the last 2 years, and you know, we've won, I think, the last 13 rallies on the trot. The only I think the last time we were second was Pirelli Rally last year, but it's been really good from a development of the product point of view. You know, UK Rally, and it was great to work with Elfin in that year in 16. as well as doing the World Championship with Hoyt. And, you know, to see him come into the World Championship in a latest car this year was obviously great, because we'd had the relationship there with him, so it worked well.
Did that force, obviously, we've all been really excited by the 17 cars and everything else, did that force you guys on even more so with the demand that's going to be on the tyre, with, you know, with the increased downforce, obviously the increased horsepower? Did that kind of almost put a gun to your head to kind of, you've got to accelerate the development now of the tyre?
Absolutely, yeah. The cars are so different, and the forces on the tyre are much more than they were in 2016. So, you know, there was a good development period at the end of 16, you know, in sort of hot gravel conditions in Spain to get the tyre developed for 17. So yeah, there was a lot of work to do, but you know, as a small team, we can change that, turn that the development around quite quickly.
That was going to be my next point. Obviously, you go up against, of course, you know, the might of Michelin at WRC level, and, you know, sometimes I suppose the bigger ship takes a little bit longer to turn around. The fact that perhaps in comparison you're in a rowing boat, does that help?
I think it certainly does when you've got, you know, the manufacturing, you know, backup that we've got with our current arrangement with Avon Cooper, because they can, you know, with us, our input, we can turn things around, you know, within a matter of weeks. Whereas when you're in a huge company, then, you know, there's a lot of politics involved and it takes a lot more time. But so it definitely does give us an advantage, for sure.
We spoke before we started doing this call. We spoke in, I suppose, the end of 2010, 2011, when you guys first entered into the WRC. At that point, was this the end game? I know it sounds like a really obvious question. Is this come at the time where you thought it would, or did you ever envisage being on you know, a high-level world rally car? Was it always initially, you know, WRC2, perhaps? You know, obviously, you were very successful in that, in 2014, winning that. So was that perhaps where you pitched it? And, you know, I don't know, really. Was this the end game? Obviously, it was, but did you think you would get there, I guess, is the question.
I think it was always the vision. The vision has always been to be competing at the top level and to win WRC rallies and to be the world rally champions at some point. We always knew that that would take at least between 5 to 10 years. But when we started, obviously, to develop the tyres at the end of 2010 to start competing in 2011, it was literally, you know, a couple of guys, and, you know, I was working on the workshop floor in China. We were building the tyres to get the tyres ready for the samples for the FIA. So it was on a completely different level. We knew we were going to go in just supplying to the privateers, and, you know, the first event we did in 2011 was Sweden Rally, and we had Martin Semerad and Martin Prokop actually on the tyres in Sweden, and actually worked out quite well because there was a lot of snow that year. And I think, you know, as we've gone through the years, we've progressed, we've showed the performance of the tyres, and, you know, you get competitors coming in, and then obviously we've made the right sort of business decisions in terms of targeting championships. You know, one of the biggest ones was obviously going into the WRC2 program with Jari Kettermaer, and then Hoyt Tanak in 2014 to win that team's cup. You know, and then obviously the natural thing to do then is to go on to the, you know, World Rally Car, you know, which we did in 16. So we've tried to progress it in the right way. Normally it's cash that stops us from doing it, but we've always had a plan. So yeah, that's how it is.
Well, the 18, you know, obviously we're still very, very early doors yet, but there's lots of things starting to happen now, perhaps drivers moving and things like that. Will we see an 18 DMAC car?
I don't think we will sponsor a car at all in 2018. I think we've had the last 2 years where we've run World Rally Car in 16 with Hoyt and 17 with Elfin. I think that we have proven that we've got a good package to offer to some of the manufacturers. Certainly what we've done this year, we've really helped M Sport win the manufacturer's title. And if you look at the points that we've scored and the stage times that we've achieved, then it proves that there is a value to having DMAC as part of a team. So, you know, we're looking and talking to various other teams and manufacturers, and hopefully you'll see DMAC tyres on a car in 2018, but at the moment nothing is confirmed.
I was just about to say, you kind of preempted the question, really. It seems an obvious one. You know, obviously, you're based in Cumbria. M Sport have been based in Cumbria. We know M Sport have got their test facility as well in Greystoke. Has that been, obviously, a very easy marriage? Because all the other teams, of course, now are splattered all over Europe. The fact you've got one, you know, 20 minutes up the road, so to speak, surely has been an advantage.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the relationship with M Sport has been fantastic over the last few years. It really started in 2013 with the introduction of the R5 car, and I mean, the first World Championship rally that car did was Finland in 2013, and we won that event with Ketema, and you know, sort of the relationship has grown from there, and it's, you know, it's like you say, the location makes a big difference. It's on the doorstep. You know, where that'll go from here on, we don't know, because you know, it's silly season at the moment. Everybody's deciding what to do, so you know, it's just the normal way. But yeah, I mean, for sure, working with Malcolm, working with M Sport has been a massive plus for DMAC over the years.
Something else that obviously you guys have been passionate about alongside M Sport, of course, was the DMAC Drive Trophy, which is now obviously kind of almost kind of gone into obviously the juniors now. Is that something else that you guys are going to remain committed to?
Certainly the Drive DMAC Trophy was a huge success for us. The JWRC, you know, it's taken a little bit of the focus away from DMAC this year, I think. So we're going to have to take a view on whether or not we're going to be involved next year. But certainly the focus that DMAC has got in terms of supporting young drivers on various championships around the world will not change. But we'll have to wait and see, you know, how the sort of tender process goes for 2018 for JWRC.
Because the tyres are now starting to appear. Well, they've been appearing for a long time, but of course, you know, we see them in America, we see them over in China and stuff like that. Was that, obviously, we went going back, that 7 years ago, probably when we spoke about it, there was a vision in order to kind of, not as much conquer the world, but certainly get the brand into different parts of the world. That still is happening, isn't it? You know, we seem to be seeing more and more cars now with the DMAC livery and the DMAC tyres and stuff like that.
We're supplying tyres to 72 countries around the world. You know, like you say, we've won the American Rally Championship with Higgins and Pastrana for the last 3 years. We've got control tyre championships in South America, in Chile and Bolivia and Paraguay and places like that. And you know, the tyre is out there competing in all different championships around the world. And that is a big focus, because at the end of the day, we are a business. We have to make money. So, you know, and we're selling competition tyres on the back of the success of the WRC. So, you know, and the only way to do that is obviously to enter into all of the championships, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to give the BRC a good push over the last 2 years.
Now, again, I suppose I remember speaking to Martin Wilkinson about this, of course, for our listeners, CA1 Sport. Now, Martin was, again, very, very similar to what we said about M Sport. You know, he felt being on the doorstep and being able to talk to you guys just by picking up the phone and you being up the road was so advantageous this season for him over perhaps previous years that he's worked with other people. And that definitely secured, you know, the championship for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did, we had a good year with CA1 Sport. It worked extremely well. And obviously, as well as CA1, we had M Sport with Cronin. And, you know, so both are in the county. So that worked really well. And I think, what we try to do is always give the best possible service service on the events, you know, technically, so to the drivers, and we had to talk about the tyres and the pressures and the compounds and things like that. So again, being a small team, you know, there's, the guys can, you know, just pick up the phone and call me direct or Brevi or any of the other guys. So, you know, it's just given that sort of, you know, service to the drivers, which, you know, in effect, in the end, helps them to win rallies and win stages.
Yeah, sorry, I nearly rewrote history there and gave Frederick Arlen the BRC title. Sorry, Frederick. I do know you're listening. I do know you're listening as well. Sorry, Frederick, if I've took you back down that dark alleyway where it wasn't a particularly happy moment when it didn't happen for you. But moving forward, Dick, 2018, it's all very, very exciting. And as you said before, it's silly season, so we don't know anything, do we, at the moment?
At the moment, no, there's nothing concrete. Like I say, we're talking to various people about competing in the championships, in the WRC, in ERC, and then various other championships around the world. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but certainly we'll be pushing to be in the championship in WRC next year at the top level and in WRC 2 as well.
ERC is an interesting one because that's probably one of the ones that perhaps, and maybe it's me being a little bit naive here, but that's not one that perhaps I've seen the DMAC brand in probably as much out of all the championships, funnily enough. Was that a conscious thing or was that just, you know, efforts in WRC 2 and, of course, WRC?
I think obviously, you know, as the company has gone through its sort of history, we've always had a very good reputation on the gravel tyres, and we've been heavily developing the tarmac tyres, you know, and you can see in the BRC this year, you know, the tyres have been performing well on tarmac and gravel. So we've got a complete package now to offer to the competitors. And certainly, like in the French Rally Championship, we've been present there as well this year on tarmac. So that obviously, you know, kicks into people having interest from the ERC, saying, well, actually, we can run DMAX for the whole year. And that's what's got us into the championship. So hopefully you'll see us there next year. And also we're trying to do some work with this new TER championship. So you'll probably see us there as well.
Perfect, perfect. Dick, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and sharing the emotions and the roller coaster that you went through this season.
Okay, no problem.
No worries. Dick Cormack, DMAC, thanks so much for joining us, folks. We'll be back after this break.
This is Absolute Rally, Pace Notes Rally Magazine, Britain and Ireland's only dedicated rally publication. Rally news, interviews, features and reports from Clubman rallies to the WRC. Available from all good newsagents or subscribe at rallymag.com. Pace Notes Rally Magazine, your number one monthly rally read. This is the Absolute Rally Podcast.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Absolute Rally, and we've got to that section of the programme. It was going to be in any other business, that's kind of how passionate we were about it, but we thought we might as well get the man on, who's not only the national editor of MM for Historic Rally, and he's also the press officer for an event which many people around the world are getting excited about. People talk about historic rallying now in such a passionate way, and Silver Fern and events like that. Of course, the RAC is back, and the RAC is back in such a way where it's visiting pretty much every corner of the UK, it feels like it, but I'm going to whittle on too much about it. Paul Lawrence, welcome back to Absolute Rally. We've had you on before, so welcome back.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be here.
Now, before Jack batters a colleague into submission on information for this event, because Jack's also on standby, just tell our listeners a little bit about where the event is going this year.
Okay, well, this year, for the first time ever, the event's going into Wales, which obviously is breaking new ground and has caused a huge amount of interest. So Friday is Wales, with some classic Welsh Forest stages after a start at Shelsley Walsh Hill Climb. Saturday, we head straight north and we're into Kielder, southern Kielder, across right into then the Western Block, stages like Ogre Hill and Harwood, then back to Carlisle. Sunday is all about Scotland, classic stages in southern Scotland, Castlelaw, Twigleys, places like that. And then on Monday, just to make sure everybody has a sting in the tail, is back into the central block of Kielder for another 60 stage miles to finish early afternoon.
Wow. Paul, the RAC's got such a fantastic reputation around the world, but I think some of the stuff that's been happening over the past few years may be not so well known outside of the UK. So for some of the listeners we've got who aren't in the UK and in the middle of reading your MN historic stuff every week, what's happened over the last few years with the event and how has it sort of come back in such a strong way this year?
Okay, yeah. It hit a rocky time. Last round in 2014, and based on what Colin Heppenstall, the rally manager, believed the competitors were looking for, it was condensed into a shorter, more compact event running predominantly in the Kielder region. Not solely, but predominantly in Kielder region. But actually, that didn't grab people's attention, grab people's imagination. So the 2015 event ultimately had to be cancelled due to lack of entries. As you can imagine, it's a massive financial undertaking to run an event of this scale. And if you don't get the entries, it just doesn't work. So 15 cancelled. Colin said, right, need to sit out and just think long and hard about this. Decided not to attempt to run anything in 2016, but launched a bigger, better, toughest ever edition for 2017 to see if actually what people wanted was a true four-day adventure, the better part of 300 stage miles covering different parts of the country, and it has worked. Having said that, the initial interest was huge, and inevitably, as we've got nearer to the event, the drop-off rate has been significant because it's a big undertaking. It's a big entry fee. It's a lot of tars. It's a long event. So we've ended up with an entry of just under 100 cars, and they'll all be gathering in Leinster on Thursday.
Fantastic. Some of the machinery is going to be quite rare, isn't it? And some people are going to get to see some cars that they maybe wouldn't get to see normally. What kind of entries can you pick out from a personal point of view that you're looking forward to seeing, but some of the rarer sort of entries that are on the list?
Yeah, obviously everybody recognises that the Escort Mark II is the weapon of choice in historic rallying, and we've got plenty of those, rest assured. But it's not just about Escort Mark IIs. We've got things like Steve Perez bringing the Lancia Stratos back on the gravel, which is fantastic. This is the event that Steve first bought and developed the Stratos to run on, and we're chuffed a bit that he's bringing it back out on the gravel because he's not been on gravel with it for some little while. We've got Jimmy McRae in the Vauxhall Chevrolet, Vauxhall Firenza, the Chevrolet-powered Firenza, which is a stunning bit of kit driven by just a superstar legend of British rallying. So that's great. And then further down the order, we've got seven Saabs of all sorts of types and denominations, including the mighty two-stroke 96. Lovely bits of kit. Make a great sound in the forest. We've got the Lancia Fulvia of Steve and Tony Graham, which again is a lovely car that we don't see very often in the forests. Out of Europe, we've got a couple of interesting Opel Mantas, one of which we're told is going to be pretty quick, so we might have to shuffle the running order a little bit. So really nice spread of cars, not just Escorts, lots of variety, Datsun 240Zs, Ricky Profit's bringing his Porsche 911 out, which we're really pleased about. So yeah, lots of variety.
Has the event invested in extra emergency crews for people fainting when they see some of these cars coming through the stages?
Well, hopefully most we find probably the demographic of our spectator is a bit higher than the average Rally GB spectator, we like to think. It's sort of appeals to the more mature rally spectators. So hopefully they'll go into the woods well equipped and well set for a little lie down when these cars come by. But you know, part of it is about the noise that these cars make. It's not just the sight; it's the sound of these things. If you stood in a dark forest with a BDG Escort or a Lancia Stratos coming towards you, that's a bit special. It makes me feel like I'm 18 or 20 years old again.
Absolutely. I think it's the first time that a four-wheel drive is going to run as part of the event as well, isn't it, Paul? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, that's a new diversion. Obviously, the current historic regs from the FIA and the MSA now allow what we call Category J2, which is cars up to 1990, which obviously takes in the early four-wheel drives. We've got two running on this event. We've got Frank Cunningham with his Ford Sapphire Cosworth, and we've got Tom Coftrey with the Mitsubishi Galant, in the style of the car used by Pentti Arikola to win the old Lombard RSC rally in, I think it was 89. So, yeah, just two of them. It's an interesting development. We'll have to wait and see how they get on.
Fantastic. And then we've also got the Open event running alongside, haven't we? So are they doing the same amount of mileage and doing the same event as well?
Yeah, the Open rally, which is for any two-wheel drive rally car. So it can be a modern MGZR or an Escort Mark II with a that's not in historic spec with a Vauxhall 60-valve engine, that sort of thing. Yep, they're running alongside the main event. Same stages, same route. They'll have their own cases and their own awards. And there's one or two quick cars in there as well, certainly.
Wow, wow. Do you know what? I know you've just touched upon it there. I'm really interested, and it makes me feel not only old, but also quite happy, the fact that there are some four-wheel drive cars coming into historic rallying now. And I guess, you know, we all kind of harp back to, you know, the legacies and obviously the Galants and things like that. Do you think that's what's going to happen, Paul? Do you think we're going to see more four-wheel drive moving forward? Obviously, we feel, and we all love an Escort, don't get me wrong, we all love an Escort, but there's times where you feel like it's just Escort, Escort, Escort. So to see different shapes and different sizes and, of course, different sounds, I think moving forward, it's only got to be good for it, hasn't it?
It's a moot point, to be honest, Tony, and a lot of people got some fairly strong views on this. I think, yeah, according to the FIA and indeed the MSA, these cars now qualify as historic. I know the BTRDA is going to introduce them into its historic cup next year. The BHRC, the British Historic Rallying Championship, said no, we're not going to let these cars in because there is a series, obviously, of alienating your entire customer base. For perhaps a small number of well-driven 4x4s. So it's an interesting world. I think the jury is out. We'll wait and see. But an interesting time, certainly.
I think so. So your role, obviously, as press officer, we're assuming you've just been saying before we started recording this, you would need a coffee. God knows what you're going to be like this time next week. But when does Paul Lawrence arrive at an event, and when does work really start for you?
Right. It'll start tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday, because tomorrow in Leinster, the visiting crews need to go through a scrutineering process to gain an MSA logbook. So they're invited to come on Wednesday so the event scrutineers can check the cars over and logbook them on Wednesday. Scrutineering itself starts in Leinster on Thursday at midday and runs through all day Thursday. We're at Shelsley Walsh from 9:30 on Friday morning, and we'll finish in the middle of Kildare, something like 2-3 o'clock on Monday afternoon, just in time to file the report that Jack will no doubt be chasing me for. And then a bit of a lie down Monday night, I guess.
I can see that coming. Now, for our listeners, and we genuinely, we do have people all over the world who are all rally fans. They're all very, very passionate. What's the best way of staying up to date with the event, Paul?
Okay, the easiest place to find out what's going on is the event Facebook page. So just go to Facebook and look for Roger Albert Clark Rally, and you'll find on there. There's lots of stuff on there. We've got a team of people out there going to be loading video, audio, words, pictures, obviously wherever we can find a phone signal. You know, some of the places we're going doesn't have much in the way of phone signal, but we'll keep that site as up-to-date as we possibly can. There will be live results via the TimeMath Computer Services system, which will link from that Facebook page. So, yeah, I'd use Facebook. The event website will be updated, but Facebook is, you can just load Facebook so quick, so constantly with bits and pieces. We reckon that's the best medium for most people.
Brilliant. Folks, you know how to find us as well. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/absoluterally. We wish all the crews the very best of luck on the RAC this coming weekend. We will be watching from afar, but nevertheless, enjoying the times coming. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. You're very welcome. Glad to talk about the event, and thanks for your support.
No worries at all. And folks, we'll be back same time, same place, in your little podcast hole next week.